Good evening. This is Mondo Homunculero. This is the Mondo Homunculero podcast coming from Thanet Aero Studios, deep in the heart of Casa de Mondo Saskia. Tonight, and this is the first nighttime podcast I've done in quite a while, this is the first of three parts. The first part has to do with a couple of different topics. First of all, we're going to talk about the self. Then we're going to talk about man's relationship to others. And then we're going to talk about the relationship to the divine or God or whatever you want to call it, those three. And I'm going to do this from a personal perspective and tie in the knowledge that I have and the experience that I have with all of this. The self. Okay, so my relationship with myself has been, it has been what I guess what you could say has happened. My earliest memories come from me living in a trailer park with my parents when I was about 4.5 years old. After my sisters were born. And hi, this is Mondo Homunculero. This is Sunday night, the 11th of July, in hotter than hell Phoenix. And I'm coming to you live from Thanet Aero Studios, deep in the heart of Casa de Mondo Saskia. Tonight is the first part of a three-part podcast I'm doing, which came to me from an old professor I had in my first year in college. He was looking at a few things, but mainly his was a literary perspective on man, his relationship to himself, his relationship to fellow humans, and also relationship to the divine. Albeit this was a humanistic perspective. I learned quite a bit from that, and it set the stage for me as a 19-year-old for the rest of my life, basically. My relationship with myself, earliest memories come from me being about 4.5, 5 years old, walking around this trailer park that was close to a school. And I would walk by the fence by the playground with a tablet in my hand, with a writing tablet in my hand. And I wanted to be in school. That's all I can remember. I wanted to learn more. I had a lot of toys also. I wasn't interested in the toys. I liked to have kids over and let them play with the toys. And then I would watch them play with the toys and see what they were doing. I didn't care much for interacting with them, although I did a bit. My mother was my chief parent at that point. She was my chief contact with my emotional and psychological life. My father was kind of distant. And after the twins, my two sisters, were born, he sort of took me over. And he began taking me places with him. I remember going up to our ranch, our cattle ranch, which was by Roosevelt Lake. I remember going up the old Apache Trail, which was mainly a dirt road. And it was kind of a scary drive going through the Salt River Canyon. I remember that fear. As I got older, my father instilled a lot of fear and shame and guilt in me. He was what have you done for me today kind of guy. And he was on a short timetable. He knew he was dying. He'd been gassed in World War I. It put a large tumor on his chest wall that was full of cancer that didn't metastasize, that had to be removed. And from that point on, he had this dance with life that was going to result in his death. And he was like a higher power to me. He was like a god to me. I had no concept of God at that point. I was pretty much just locked into the family dynamic. And you know, when your God treats you like shit and demeans you and puts you down, tells you you're never going to be worth anything until you prove your worth, you know, I didn't have a very good opinion of myself, as I found out later. And I grew to hate him because he was such a mean son of a bitch. Now, he was very well loved by other men. And he was a man's man, and he was very tough, and he did have a tough form of compassion. He was all about the underdog. And others told me he thought the world of me, but he didn't show me that to my face. And so that was not a good thing to do. And when I started working with my own son, I didn't treat him that way. I treated him like he was gold. Unfortunately, he had an inherent death wish and wound up taking his own life at the age of 30. Pretty sad. At any rate, my relationship with myself began to develop after my father died when I was 16. And up to that point, I just wanted him to be out of the way, but I also wanted to take over the family empire of horse racing and cattle ranching. Primarily, I wanted to run the horse racing. I thought I could be a great thoroughbred trainer, horse racing trainer. And as it turned out, I didn't get the opportunity because of his death. At that point, everything kind of went out the window for me. I felt lost. I thought maybe I would practice or, you know, get a law degree, learn to practice law. Had an in at Dartmouth College. Didn't take up on it. Was interested in women and girlfriends. Had a couple of girlfriends. Had one girlfriend that I was with for a long time. And kind of introduced ourselves to sexuality, even though we were still virgins when we broke up. Wound up going with her former best girlfriend and losing or breaking the virginity or whatever, becoming sexually active with her. That was a beautiful thing. She was a beautiful person. Still is, I guess, from what I hear from people who know her. She's been married, has children, beat breast cancer. Kind of a tough deal for her, but what a lovely person she was and probably still is. Now, me, I was really not liking myself and not liking what my milieu was. My family wanted me to become a veterinarian. And I didn't really want to be a veterinarian, but I thought, what the heck, if I do it, I can make money and I can be on the racetrack and be close to the horse racing that I loved. I went to community college and then went to undergraduate and back to high school now. High school was actually a great experience for me, even after my father's death. I didn't grieve it too well, so I started getting involved with recreational drugs, like cannabis and alcohol. Alcohol was not a good thing for me. Cannabis probably would have been if the alcohol hadn't been around. And it wasn't always around. And back in those days, the cannabis was really weak. It wasn't very strong. So you didn't get real high when you smoked a bunch of Mexican weed. High school was a lot of fun, especially junior and senior years. There was a group of us that hung out together quite a bit. And actually, a lot of us still hang out occasionally. It's pretty cool to be my age and be connected with those people, and they're great people, and I love them dearly, and I love getting together with them when I can. So that was a great experience for me as well, high school. Excellent. I did well in school, graduated in the top 5%. I was very social studies oriented, started to get into art. at the end of high school, and I was in the Model UN. We had the Model UN that we did every year, and I was in that. I've forgotten now what country it was that I represented. I think it might have been New Zealand, but I'm not completely sure. But at any rate, that was a lot of fun. Ran for student government, became senior class vice president, ran a pretty aggressive campaign, beat out my opponent, who was a conservative, even then, like Richard Nixon. Oh, my God. Now, that was when I became involved in left-wing ideologies and politics. Had a friend who's still a friend, actually kind of resurfaced a few years ago through social media, who is a physician now and has been a physician for many, many years. And he introduced me to left-wing politics, to Abby Hoffman. And, you know, Abby Hoffman was kind of my favorite. So was the other guy, Jerry Rubin. He was in the Chicago 7. And all those guys. And the Students for a Democratic Society, of which I was a member of a high school wing of it called Student Mobilization Committee. Went to a lot of marches and protests and all those types of things and really liked it. Now, all this time, I was really not aware of my relationship with myself. I was just kind of a ship cut adrift. And when my girlfriend, who meant the world to me, probably would have married her if she would have stayed here, if her parents didn't move away. My girlfriend, when she moved away, I was destroyed. And I think a lot of that was grief that was misplaced from the death of my father that I never felt. So I kind of went crazy after that, kind of stayed crazy for quite a while, did some really horrible things. Basically told her parents that her and I had sex and that they were dirty, no good bastards and all that kind of thing. Which they were. They were very controlling of her. And I think one of the reasons they moved was to get her away from me. They felt that if they got to a nice, safe community, she wouldn't be involved with drugs anymore. And maybe she always did not want to be involved with drugs, but she didn't use drugs that much anyway. So around this time, I began experimenting with psychedelics. And I would kind of experience what one of my later friends would call psychedelic shame. When I would get loaded, it would be a very profound experience on LSD, especially. Most of the time, it was like I acknowledged the connection to everything. In other words, what in the Timothy Leary's Eighth Circuit Model says is the Eighth Circuit, you know, a connection with the mother lode, with the everything, with the all. You know, with what some people call God. I really didn't like calling that God. It was too big to be called that, in my opinion. So I got connected with that, and that was a very profound and a very positive thing. And there were a lot of things that came out of that that later on made sense. And I went from there to going to school, went all the way through pre-veterinary. Woke up one morning, decided didn't want to do that, and got into research for a while. Worked on a master's degree in a really cool program that didn't make it to PhD, and I was really sad about that. It's kind of a drag, and so that was what I was doing then, and that went on for about 6 years. Not the grad school, but the entire college career. And during this time, still had this kind of feeling of inner strength, however, felt very lost. Now, there were some things that came up during that time period from the teen years up through the mid-20s, one of which is that the self doesn't exist. Yes, the self in the Eastern view either does not exist or it's part of a greater self, which is kind of the Atman situation, which is all things together, and this is a greater self inside and outside the person. I sort of like those views much better. I read a lot of Alan Watts in those days, and I really liked Alan Watts' book about not existing or not being, as he called it. And I don't think we are beings. I think we do. I don't think we're like beings. Because what that gets around to, in my view, is that we exist, and maybe we don't. Maybe we're just a hallucination of some greater force. Okay, I don't necessarily buy that. I don't think that's an adequate description, because what my life has consisted of is great amounts of doing things. Thinking is a form of doing, as far as I'm concerned. Believing is a form of doing, as far as I'm concerned. I'm with Count Kibiski on this one. So I really think that we do. We don't necessarily be. Anyway, along those lines, the grief had me tortured inside for many, many years. And when I was 19, I was working for the city of Phoenix as a court tender. And at that time, I got introduced to some crazed evangelical Christians. And they were very, very crazed, in my opinion. So, at that particular point, I got saved. I started hanging around with these people. I started reading the Bible every day, throughout the day and in the evenings. I quit smoking pot and taking any other drugs. I drank a little bit, not too much. So that was basically my situation with that. Apologies for the interruption with devices not being set up and going into them making noise. I got swept into the cult, which was called at the time the Phoenix Light Temple. They were crazy. I had this really wild baptism of the Holy Spirit experience where this feeling came over me, and I had to be in this one specific spot at the altar, which maybe there was some kind of device, some electronic or electromagnetic device under it that caused this to happen. But it was a truly exhilarating experience, which had no mystical connection as far as I was concerned. It was physical. And at that point, I began to become a well-ordained Jesus freak. At any rate, something was wrong with all of that. It didn't really work for me, and I don't think it works because I don't believe that it's real. I think it's a falsehood. And I think believing in any God for any period of time can be very beneficial, in that we can take on the characteristics of that God. This is called invocation. Or we can ask that God to protect us or to strengthen us in some way. And if we believe it's strong enough, that intention will come to us and come to fruition in a lot of cases. That doesn't mean the God actually exists or is real. At that point, I had gone back to college. I took a course from Dr. Melvin Weiser, and he was a writer. He was a screenwriter and actually wrote quite a bit of the Little Big Man script. And he liked to view the Bible as literature. We had a book which was called The Bible as Literature. And so we began to look at the Bible as literature and see that how man changed in his neuroevolution, I call it that, we didn't back then, that the concept of God changed, because we went from this, in the Hebrew tradition, we went from this hateful, spiteful God who was trying to establish his people as the number one people in the world and give them all the breaks and then punish them when they did wrong things, all those types of things. So at that point, it got to be a little tedious. It was very good, though, because it taught me what I'm doing here today, which is my relationship to myself, my relationship to my fellow man, and my relationship to the divine. And so I saw how God changed in the persona of Jesus Christ and his writers like Paul from being this hateful, mean God to being a very loving and compassionate God who welcomed all. And there's a lot of dispute on whether any of that's correct or not. I'm not interested in that right at this point in this segment. At that point, I abandoned Christianity. I still had a superstitious belief in it, even had dreams where the devil was standing in the doorway of my bedroom and beckoning me. Of course, that was after I saw The Exorcist, and it gave a lot of people nightmares. I read the book as well. And what I say to anyone, you know, the subconscious can pull in a lot of thoughts, ideas, and beliefs, and it can poison us. It can make us do things we don't want to do. In moving on from that, I became more centered in my career. And from the age of 16, actually earlier, I began to drink, which to me, alcohol is a drug. I was drinking alcohol again here recently after over 30 years of not participating in taking alcohol. And it was causing me a lot of physical problems like inflammation and so forth, so I stopped drinking. During these years, from like 16 on, I was a heavy user of alcohol, cannabis, sometimes amphetamine, psychedelics, which I don't consider to be a habitual drug to be abused, okay? And other drugs, even opium at one point. I used these drugs quite a bit, off and on. I would get straight for a few days, and then I would use for a few months. I remember staying drunk once for 6 years. That's right, I got drunk every day for 6 years. Then I also used cannabis along with the alcohol. Alcohol was not a drug of choice for me. It was more like the soup before the main courses. And drug use for me was more like a 3-7-course meal. At one point, I became involved with cocaine. Cocaine was a big love affair for me, but it was also the demon of the fall. In other words, it was a demon that almost destroyed my life. Not a real demon per se. However, just not a very good drug. Not, you know, maybe good for short bursts of whatever. You know, some of the things that Freud learned from cocaine, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, for me, it was a bad situation because I used it very addictively. And I was an IV drug user of that particular drug. Then I started having overdoses. Now, we're jumping now into my 30s. I started having overdoses all the while. I was still using quite a bit of alcohol. I was still smoking a lot of cannabis, so forth. This is not really a drug-a-log, so I won't go into all of that. But at one point, it became very, very, very dangerous for me because I began overdosing, going into respiratory arrest and so forth. Almost dying. I actually did die twice and came back. And my take on that is there's nothing out there. It's oblivion. You can say whatever you want to say. I had some of the experiences, however, they didn't play out. They're just basically the artifacts of my own mind. And during this time, I began to examine my relationship to myself. At one point in 1986, I had a fatal overdose that I came back to life from. I was in a coma for 3 days. Before that, I had died and come back to life. And at that point, I had a profound realization that what I was doing was killing me and that I had better stop if I wanted to continue living. And the bottom line was, I wanted to live more than I wanted to die. And what I was doing was going to cause my death. So it was sort of a form of suicide, as they say in the program, suicide on the installment plan. At that point, I got involved in the 12-step program in Narcotics Anonymous. I went to a treatment center. I got help. And what I found out is I didn't have to use anymore. I also found out that, you know, I could hang around with a bunch of people who weren't using and who had found a way to live without using. However, I began to see the flaws in that, and that it was a cult. It is a cult. I watch the way people live in it and practice it and believe about it, and it's a cult. And, okay, if you want to be in a cult, that's okay with me. I'm not going to be in that cult. I don't want to be a part of that cult. I don't like it. I don't like the lies and misinformation that it spreads, because I don't believe addiction is a disease. I don't think there's anything to warrant that it's a disease, even though it may cause disease, even though it has a disease condition which may follow, or two, or five. Addiction itself is not a disease. It's. I like how it's now defined in the DSM, the latest version, as a substance abuse disorder. And I had that. And I overcame it. And how did I overcome it? By not participating in it and by finding other pursuits. Well, I stayed clean for a long time. Now, I don't use the word sober because I think it's inadequate to describe the abstinence that I undertook. I think sober is a ridiculously old, antiquated term from Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a program I despise. Why do I despise it? I'm not going to go into that. That's not the subject of this. However, I believe it hurts more people than it helps, and it turns people away who need the kind of help it could offer if it was just basically peer support. And in that, I began to do a lot of self-development work, because I found that the 12 steps, didn't want to admit it, because let's face it, I was a dedicated cult member. I was what they call an NA purist, or Nazi as the, you know, derogatory term. I didn't like Narcotics Anonymous fellowship that much. There were a lot of people there who I think are deranged. They're the kind of people that would vote for Trump. They're the kind of people that just have these crazy, crazy views on life. And those views are not my perspective. Increasingly, I began to see that the God that I had before was not real, and that, you know, maybe I should adopt some other form of higher power. So I began to embrace, like, the Taoist higher power type of thinking, God as the all of everything type of thinking, the mother lode, all of that. Only to find that, for me, that wasn't real as well. That there is no God. There might be some conglomeration of cosmic forces that have some kind of say-so in determining the direction that life on Earth goes, or even life throughout the universe, or even the progress or the entropy of the universe. However, my science education became very strong and caused me to become more of an atheist materialist, with a deterministic view on things to a certain extent. I didn't want to accept hardcore determinism because I believed in free will quite a bit, and that we had a big say-so in our destinies. And today I still believe we have a say-so in our destinies. We are restricted by biological factors. We are restricted by several different factors, like the opportunities that we may have in our lives. And I saw that firsthand. And through that time period of about, I'd say, the first 15 years, there was a lot of progress that was made due to some self-development programs that I engaged in outside of Narcotics Anonymous. Narcotics Anonymous kind of gave me a foothold. And nowadays, I view the self as this. I started out believing there was probably no self. And then I started to believe that there was a self, and that God made it, and that God didn't make junk, so I had infinite worth. This was something I learned from a program called Omega Vector, which borrowed those ideas, of course, from somewhere else. Then I evolved away from that in that back to my Buddhist views, which there is no self. Nothing is real. Everything is almost like a dream. The ultimate reality is connecting with the cosmic power of the universe, which is not a sentient power. It just is the power that kind of is the underlying force of the universe. So the force be with you sort of thing. And through that, I began to see that the self, once you get self-esteem, you don't need it anymore because there is no self. And it's actually a beautiful thing because there's nothing to put down, nothing to build up. There's things to do, and that we can decide on what we want to do. And I kind of like what Camus, Albert Camus, said about all this. Now, Camus thought everything was absurd. He was an absurdist. And he thought that the main problem in our world was ignorance. People just don't know enough about themselves, others, or anything else to really shape their own destiny, so to speak. Camus believed that you create your own reality in your own universe, so to speak. And that's what I grasped onto and still believe today, that we create our own realities. Now, I also like what Robert Anton Wilson had written about quite a bit, which is reality tunnels. Now, if you don't know who Robert Anton Wilson is, he wrote many books. He's easy to access on the internet. You can look his writings up. He even has quite a few videos of his talks, his audio talks on YouTube. You can listen to a lot of those and see where he was coming from. And he was big on Leary's 8-circuit model. And I went all the way through the model, and I thought that that applied to me very, very well. I think nowadays that we engage ourselves in philosophies and thinking that fits what is now our model of realities or the universe. Nowadays, I think basically along evolutionary lines that our biological purpose has to do with reproducing. And that's really what our purpose, if there is one, is. And that the rest of everything is kind of contrived, meaning like what Dr. Donald Hoffman says, and I just can't push his ideas enough to you all, not that you would subscribe to him whatsoever, or you might think he's completely full of shit. However, he thinks that everything is kind of useful sets of falsehoods. In other words, almost like icons on a computer screen that are not visual representations of the ones and zeros that make up the programming, and that there probably is an ultimate reality beyond everything. However, we don't know what it is, and we don't have to, because we are here simply to evolve. And when I look at this on a long-term level, what I see is that we have evolved. Homo sapiens, sapiens, which is what we are species-wise, has been evolving for 100,000 years. And most of that has been neuroevolution. Our nervous systems have adapted socially and evolved socially into very complex relationships and so forth. And this is written about in great detail by many authors. And I think that that's, to me, very plausible and a very useful falsehood, as it were, according to Hoffman's model. And once I got rid of the whole self-esteem nightmare, I do think that it is good practice to go through all the steps. In other words, realize that you probably have a self. In other words, an individual self, and that it has infinite worth, and that your job is to build it up and give yourself credit for having infinite worth. And once that is attained, and you can, and it isn't perfect, there's caveats, there's pluses and minuses, There's assets and liabilities inside that self. And when we accept that, we get a sense of a humility. And this will lead us, if we wish, to the next step, which is no self. And that goes back to the ideas of Wilson and Korbisky and even to some extent Crowley, not so much Crowley. But a lot of the later age folks, that the self is a contrivance. We contrive it. And I kind of lay that over on the model that Dilts developed, which is a great model as far as I'm concerned, which says that all of us need to identify what our mission in life is, or our purpose, or create that if we don't have one intrinsically, or if the one that we find intrinsically is not to our liking. And these are called logical levels. Now, once again, none of this is the absolute truth. These are just useful pathways as far as I'm concerned. And the very first one is that mission, that purpose in life. Then the second stage of that. Now, this is an overused term in the last 5-10 years, purpose. People got to have this purpose. Wah, 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 wah. And it gets very much misconstrued because there's a lot of ignorance behind it. There's not enough discovery and exploration of what that can really mean. Since I adopt the view that life is happens through doing and not being, then purpose centers around what that consists of. Now, mine has to do with creativity and personal power, increasing and maintaining creative personal power. That's my purpose or mission. Then we have our identity. Now, I'm not going to go all the way into all of these because they're not important here. Just to tell you that these have worked for me and they've been working for a long time now. And I've had a lot of personal success in life because I've adopted these. And of course, I've done a lot of wrong things. I've done things, made big mistakes, lost a lot of money, made a lot of money, had good relationships which lasted for years and then didn't continue anymore, things like that. And through all of this, I have this sense of, man, I'm just doing what I'm doing, and in the end, it's working out well. And the second part is identity, and I see identity as malleable. In other words, we can change our identity to suit our purpose. We can create and destroy our identities as we're going along. In other words, we can do that dance of Shiva with our identity. And it's a very good thing. There are several other levels in the logical levels that was put forth by Robert Dilts. At some point, I became a student of neurolinguistic programming. I am by no means an expert on it. I am a practitioner. I was trained by a couple of guys that I have great respect for in that. And we had a falling out over me not wanting to be a follower of anything, which is just the way I am. I don't want to be your follower. I don't necessarily want to lead you either. I'm doing what I'm doing, and I'm working at improving the results that I get. Because for me, life today is all about results. And my relation to myself is probably the best it's ever been because I have placed at the center of it health. My health is more important than anything. I've survived hepatitis C. I've survived several other health problems, diseases and so forth, and come through them very, very well and been restored to a type of health that I had before I got these problems. Today I'm working with a lot of back problems, which have decreased my mobility and things like that. And I just hope that I can continue to progress. I had a lot of neuropathy, and now I'm feeling my toes and the bottoms of my feet. And it's a wonderful situation. And in closing this segment, I just want to say that this has all been very, very helpful for me. My relationship with myself has grown very much so. And it has bled over, of course, into my relationship with others. There's been a crossover there, because a lot of my relationships with others have improved my relationship with myself. So this is the end of part one. It's by no means the end of this personal study. However, I'm going to go on to part two in the next segment.